Hello. In tonight's Quantum Leap, the new search engine that will be able to recognize your face in a photograph. Research to keep your blood flowing freely. The latest offering from Microsoft. Plus, what to watch for in the heavens above. Paul Simon there, and we begin with diamonds. Now, the movie Blood Diamond opened in cinemas around Ireland this week, and we usually think of diamonds as coming from exotic places such as Africa, India and Brazil. But strange though it may seem, there could be diamonds in Ireland. In the past decade, an international company has been prospecting for diamonds in County Donegal. And 200 years ago, a diamond was found in County Fermanagh. Well, here to tell me more about the possibility of Irish diamonds is a diamond geologist, Barry Long, formerly of the Geological Survey of Ireland and a man who once spent several years prospecting for diamonds in West Africa. Barry Long, can we begin just by asking, what are diamonds?
A diamond is a very pure form of carbon with a regular and particular crystalline structure. Its structure makes it the hardest known substance.
How does a diamond form?
Well, diamonds naturally form deep below the Earth's surface, where the temperatures and pressures are high and other conditions are suitable. The temperatures would be about 1100 degrees Celsius, maybe up to 1200 degrees Celsius. This would be at a depth of about 150 kilometres, deep in the root beneath the older part of a continent.
How old are diamonds?
Most diamonds would be just over 3 billion years old. That's 3,000 million years old.
So if they naturally form 150 kilometres below the surface of the Earth, how do they come up to the surface where they can be mined?
Well, they're dependent on molten rock being released from great depths. And this molten magma rises through the area of the mantle where the diamonds reside and scavenges them and transports them to the surface. The rock that transports them is most commonly kimberlite, and kimberlite was named after the Kimberley mine in South Africa.
But I gather that our notion of the formations has grown. There are now, we know, more rock formations where we might find diamonds, and some of these could occur in County Donegal. Is that right?
You're quite right. Our understanding of diamond geology has in fact changed quite radically, particularly in the last 20 years. Kimberlite is associated only with the older parts of continents. Diamonds are found in some kimberlite bodies and in secondary deposits derived from them. However, geologists now appreciate that certain other volcanic rocks, especially lamproite, intrude the younger rocks adjacent to the oldest continental cores and are also potential carriers of diamonds, though they're only rarely of economic importance. Additionally, an oceanic plate descending deep beneath a continental margin, such as we find today around the rim of the Pacific Ocean, can generate diamonds within itself because pressure and heat increase appropriately.
So this would be where a continental plate is falling down.
It's slowly sinking beneath the continental margin.
And that can give us the temperatures and pressures
that
would form
diamonds.
That's
right. Okay. And there, of course, it's important because such diamonds can form at a depth of as little as 120 kilometres because the temperature is lower than usual at this depth. Thus favouring diamond formation and not graphite.
Mind you, 120 kilometres still sounds very deep to me.
But it does give the opportunity for other volcanic rocks that normally originate at slightly shallower depths than kimberlite to be generated and still not be too shallow.
What did Cambridge Mineral Resources find in Donegal?
Well, they looked for diamonds and sapphires in Inishowen. They were the two minerals that they hoped that they might learn more about. Published accounts by Cambridge Mineral Resources reveal that stream sediment samples contain small sapphires, rubies and diamond indicator minerals. Indicator minerals are sometimes known as diamond pathfinder minerals. Detailed studies of these pathfinder minerals showed they had formed at depths compatible with the conditions needed to form diamonds.
So we're finding things that suggest the same conditions could form diamonds. So
exactly.
These are good indicators.
These were promising indicators.
There was one diamond found in Ireland about 200 years ago in County Fermanagh in a stream. What do we know about that diamond?
This diamond was found in the year 1816 by a young girl. It was a rough diamond and it was found in the Colebrook River near Enniskillen in County Fermanagh. The girl passed it to a local landowner, Lady Brooke, Some years later, her husband, Sir Henry Brooke, returned home from Brazil, and he identified it as a diamond and had this confirmed in Dublin. And later that the diamond was cut and mounted in Wicklow gold. Became known as the Brookeborough diamond, named after the nearby village.
Do we know how... So it is a genuine diamond?
It is a genuine diamond, but we don't know how it came to be in the Colebrook River of Fermanagh. No kimberlite is known in Ireland, and until very recently no lamproite was known. But modern diamond geology offers more options than previously available. The diamond may perhaps have come from Brazil or India, because diamonds weren't known in South Africa until much later than the find. The family possibly knew diamond importers at the time, and Sir Henry himself travelled.
So it could be that they had got it from someone, it had got dropped in the stream, it didn't actually originate in Ireland. Is that?
We can't say that it didn't.
Okay.
Geologically, it still remains a possibility. It may seem somewhat unlikely, but we simply don't know the answer.
Okay.
Geochemical analysis would be useful, but the family's never been interested in having their gem analysed.
Intriguing. You'd think if you were sitting on the only diamond found in Ireland that you'd like to know if there might be more out there. But anyway, thank you. That's the Colebrook, or the Brookeborough diamond from County Fermanagh. Barry Long, thank you. You're listening to The Quantum Leap with me, Mary Mulvihill. Still to come, a new website and search engine that claims it will be able to recognise faces. But first, the science of blood clotting. Now, our blood is an amazing fluid. It normally flows freely, but at the first sign of a cut, it can begin to clot instantly. Usually it keeps that fine balance between flowing freely and clotting, but occasionally a clot can form inside your body when it shouldn't, and when that happens, it can lead to life-threatening conditions such as a stroke. So scientists around the world are working to understand what makes blood clot. And much of that research is happening in Ireland, including a team at the Royal College of Surgeons in Dublin, led by Professor Niamh Moran.
My interest lies in heart disease and understanding heart disease so we can potentially develop better ways of treating and preventing heart disease. We would say upwards of 35% of people in the Western world die of heart disease. But in particular, we focus on the role of the blood platelet in heart disease.
And sorry, what's the connection between heart disease and blood clotting, which I know is your big interest?
Well, the subcomponents that we look at of heart disease, which is heart attacks, angina, which is the chest pain that people experience prior to a heart attack, or maybe thrombotic stroke, that's caused when your blood clots inappropriately in an intact blood vessel. And the stimulus for that is that the blood platelets think there is damage.
Okay.
So if I put it in context, if you fall off your bike and you cut your leg, cut your knee and you're bleeding, that's damage to your blood vessel. On the other hand, if you, as you age, you get atherosclerotic vessels, and there, when people say you've got hardening of your arteries, that's atherosclerosis. The atherosclerotic vessel can act as a stimulus, which the blood doesn't really know the difference between a damaged blood vessel with atherosclerosis and a damaged one because you fell off your bike.
Now, you mentioned blood platelets. I've heard of blood cells, red blood cells, white blood cells. What are platelets?
Platelets are the smallest component of blood, and they're often overlooked. They're very small. Technically speaking, they might not even be called a cell because they don't have a nucleus. They're made in the bone marrow, and they bud off big cells in the bone marrow, and they're released into the flowing blood. But other than not having a nucleus, they have every other component that a cell has. So we consistently refer to them as the smallest cellular component of the blood.
Are you actually using blood in your laboratory in your studies?
We use blood every day in our laboratory. We start off an experimental day by collecting blood. Now, you may ask, where do we get that blood from? We're not adjacent to a hospital site. So what we do is we get blood from normal donors. And that's nice because it allows us to look at normal processes in normal blood. We do some work with Beaumont where we get blood from people with disease.
How does the study start?
Okay, what we do is we take the blood and we spin it in a centrifuge. And the centrifugal forces will bring down to the bottom of the tube the red cells.
So this is basically a very fast spinning bucket.
Basically a fast spinning bucket. And what it'll do is it'll take the red cells down into the bottom of the tube and leave in suspension on top the platelets that are in suspension in the plasma of the blood. Now, the reason that we do that is that we can't actually examine any of the platelet function with our laboratory instruments if we have this dense contribution of red blood cells.
They get in the way.
They get in the way and they interfere with our measurements. So we have here two tubes that we've prepared earlier. this one is whole blood as it was taken from a donor this morning, me. Okay, this one is the same tube that has, or the equivalent tube that has been spun.
Okay, so one is a red blood sample in a test tube, and now it's separated. It's like
two stripes.
It's like salad dressing. It's like the oil on top and the vinegar below, or something
exactly
like that.
It's red
blood cells at the bottom and a clear layer.
And that's
at the
because
top.
The red cells are heavier than the platelets because they're bigger. Also, what you can't really see or really appreciate is that there's a white cell layer in between. It's called the buffy coat, and so people who do work on white cells will selectively take that layer off this tube. But we just take the very top of that layer off and put it into another tube for our studies, and we call it platelet-rich plasma.
Okay. What happens to platelets when blood clots?
They're initially round and silky as they circulate in the blood. Once they perceive damage, they immediately settle down on the damaged area, and they send out little extensions of their cells. Right? And over a period of time, they will increase in size. They'll decrease in height, but increase in size. So they'll spread, essentially, on the damaged blood vessel. They'll increase in diameter by about 20-fold. So they go from a very, very small cell to quite a big sticky plaster type of affair.
So they're kind of patching a puncture in a way.
Basically, they overlap with each other and they patch a puncture. Now, remember, they're designed to do that for when you fall off your bike or fall out of the tree. But when they do that inappropriately that we become interested.
How do you mimic the clotting? How do you get the platelets to clot?
We have a machine in here that's called a platelet aggregometer. And a platelet aggregometer will look at platelet aggregation or platelet stickiness. Okay, and in it we take this platelet-rich plasma and we stir it. Now the stirring we do in order to mimic blood flow, because blood flows very very fast through your body. Okay, so that we stir it very fast to literally imitate the effect of blood being pumped through your body by your heart. And then we add various chemicals to imitate the effect of a damaged blood vessel.
So you basically
trick it into thinking that it is in a blood vessel and the blood vessel has just been damaged.
Can we see this in action?
Okay, I'm just putting 1/4 ml of platelet-rich plasma into a tube. Okay, in a machine that has the capacity to mimic platelet aggregation. The machine will heat it up to 37 degrees and
warms
it to blood temperature. We'll insert a little magnet into the machine.
Your assistant Gerard here.
So this is Gerard Kavanagh, who works in the lab, and Gerard has been preparing these samples.
Oh, so that's your magnet stirrer. That's just going to the little test tube.
Okay, and it stirs at 1,100 revs per minute.
Hey, Jane, is that the equivalent to blood flow?
It's the equivalent shear to blood flow. So that the shear effect or the drag effect of the blood cells against the edges are the equivalent to flowing blood. Okay, what I've just done now is put the blood plasma, the empty plasma that has no platelets in it, into the machine just to zero it, basically. And having done that, I now press the button, and you can see there it says 0.1% aggregation. That's baseline, right? It does this on the basis of light transmission. And then what we do is we add a simulator, the chemical that I say will simulate blood clotting.
So this is a signal, will tell the platelets.
It's now time to clot.
Time to clot. We're going to see a readout here on the screen.
Wow.
It's already started to go up. 4%, 5%, 6%, 7%. It's clicking up faster. We're up to 12% now.
Okay.
So this is, the blood is getting thicker, light isn't getting through. Is that it?
It's the opposite. Blood is getting thicker, the platelets are clotting and they're falling to the bottom of the tube, so more light is getting through. You can see how fast it's happening. It's at 33% now. It'll go to a maximum of about 70%, and that's a full blood clot. So you can see that when you do fall off your bike and you do damage your blood vessel, your platelets will very quickly mobilise and you'll clot very fast.
It's instantaneous, isn't
Absolutely
it?
Instant. Well, within seconds. We're about, 20 seconds into it now, we've got 61%.
Okay, and we can hear it clicking up in the background.
Thank you
and your team have helped to improve our understanding of this whole process. You've discovered one of the molecular switches involved in switching platelets from their normal silky to their sticky thing.
That's right. Now, we did that. That was work that we published a number of years ago, where we basically used the human genome to look at sequences in platelet proteins. And we took the view that by definition, if evolution had conserved a protein sequence, that it was important. And so we took a highly evolutionary conserved sequence, we made a synthetic peptide with it, along with the people in the chemistry department here in RCSI.
What's a synthetic peptide?
A synthetic peptide is a chemical that mimics mimics a protein. Okay, or a small portion of a protein. And we've done that over the last number of years then. So a number of years ago, we made this synthetic peptide that mimics a switch. And then we've spent a number of subsequent years trying to identify things that will then inhibit platelet function. Because we're not that interested in artificially switching on platelet function, but we're very interested in knowing how to turn it off when a patient, for example, experiences a heart attack or a severe bout of angina.
So you have now found at least one, possibly more, small molecules that can be used to prevent platelets getting sticky.
Exactly that.
Is there commercial interest in these at this stage?
There is potentially. The problem is that when you start off at a very low level or a very early level in the drug development process. So while there's commercial interest, they want us to develop it a little bit further. So we've made what I call a synthetic peptide, which is something that mimics a protein, and they don't make good drugs because if you try and give a peptide as a drug, your body has loads of ways of breaking down peptides because, after all, that's what we do when we digest food. We break down proteins. So we then have to, again, go back to the chemists here at RCSI and try and get them to develop a compound that looks the same as our peptide, but that doesn't have the exact chemical structures.
Isn't going to get broken
They're
down.
They're called peptidomimetics.
Okay, exactly peptidomimetics. That. Watch that one. How would your molecule that will prevent clotting, hopefully, how will that compare with, say, aspirin or warfarin that people might be on?
Okay, well, that's our aim, really. Aspirin is a drug that is used widely for the treatment or prevention of heart disease. And our aim would be to get a drug that is better than aspirin. Aspirin actively helps to reduce about 25% of the incidence of heart disease, or probably more correctly, I could say it reduces the severe effects, the manifestation of a heart attack in 25% of people. If you add aspirin with some other drugs, you can decrease that down to about 50%, but we'd like to be able to decrease the incidence of heart disease down below that again.
So you're looking for a drug that will work better than aspirin.
That's what we're looking for.
Final quick question, who funds this research?
The HRB has been very good to us up till now.
And
they
the
have
HRB
funded,
is?
The HRB is the Health Research Board. They have funded a large programme grant that I work on with Professor Dermot Kenny for the last 5 years, and that has been very good. We also get some funding from SFI and have been funded in the HEA programme for research in third level institutes as well.
That was Professor Niamh Moran at the Royal College of Surgeons in Dublin. Now, the World Wide Web started out as a place that was full of text and words, but increasingly it's become a place full of pictures and, more recently, videos. So the race is on to develop search engines that can recognise images. Already, a couple of sites can handle simple objects like shoes and handbags, which is useful for online shopping if you want to find a pair of red shoes that look like a pair of black shoes you might already have. But the real challenge is going to be recognising faces. Now, a new website called Polar Rose claims to be able to do that. With me to discuss this development and the privacy and security questions it might raise is technology journalist Ronan Fitzgerald. Ronan, this new website called PolarRose.com, what's new about it?
Well, traditionally, you know, when we search for an image, we're searching for tags or we're searching for details that are connected to the image, you know. So, you know, with the Google search or with similar, actually what you're finding is, you know, a piece of information nearby the image or attached to it. And with Polar Rose or similar technologies, you know, you're searching for the image itself based on the makeup of the image, you know. So you could, in theory, you know, put an image into these search engines, whether it's for an object or hopefully in future a face. And Polar Rose claims to do that. And then you can find, you know, similar images that match it, you know. And you're actually matching by how the image looks, you know, rather than information that someone has tagged to it.
So how do they work? How do they do this matching?
Well, Polar Rose, it's the Swedish company that they do faces, and they've concentrated on faces, and they work by creating what they call a face print, you know, and it basically divides the picture into a 3D image, you know, rather than just the 2D one that you have to begin with. It's divided into a number of sectors and segments, and they you know, you can scan for sort of similar matches that way. You know, it's about as simple as you can break it down to. And then like.com, that's for objects. And that works using algorithms. So it's quite a complex the way that one works. You know, about as a, to put it sort of in layman's terms, they give every photo sort of a complicated numerical code, you know, and then they you can search, you know, for more photos that match that code as such. But it's you know, there's extreme mathematics involved with that one.
Okay, so they're sophisticated and they're using algorithms. Have you tried these sites?
Well, Polar Rose at the moment is in beta, so they're not allowing you to try, you know. So you have to go on what they claim and what they tell you they can do. But I have tried like.com, which is the shopping search engine, you know, and I found it to be very accurate, you know. I suppose the only problem for ourselves in Ireland is that a lot of the sites and shopping sites it deals with won't deliver to here, you know. But in terms of how the technology works and the potential for it to be maybe developed by a business here or in the UK, I was quite impressed. You pick a pair of shoes that you like. You can pick, say, if it's the toe of a particular type of shoe that you're interested in, you can highlight that. You can specify if it's the size or colour that interests you, you know, and the results are really good, you know. I thought really impressive.
And can you upload an image of your own favourite pair of boots and say, I want to find a pair just like that?
Yeah, well, that's a feature that they have in the works, you know. I spoke to the CEO of like.com and he says that's a feature that's coming and that'll be quite useful because, you know, if you break a plate or if you have a favourite item of clothing, as a lot of people would, you know, you don't have to search for something new. You can scan in something you already have and say, find me something like this, you know, the way, and say why you like it as well, which is quite important, you know.
Okay. Paula Rose, the one that recognises the faces, why would somebody want to use a site like that?
Well, there's a number of uses, you know, and they range from the frivolous and social to the more sinister, I suppose, you know. And so I suppose the first one is it's very handy for organising photos, you know. Instead of tagging a photo like we do on photo sharing sites at the moment, you can simply, you know, upload your photo, and then the next time you upload it, it'll say, well, that's, you know, it'll recognise you, and it will know who the photo is. And then, of course, you know, there's other uses in security, which, you know, Polar Rose are claiming not to be involved in this, but some of the security services already in Britain are using some facial recognition technology. And, you know, these are some of the other uses that we can foresee being employed.
Because I presume there are privacy and security issues. I mean, this is an engine that will recognise a face in a crowd, presumably.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose the first privacy issue is simply I'm on the train home and somebody takes a photo of me and then with this technology could use it to look for more photos of me online, and who knows what details are attached to a photo of a person, a name or people can leave addresses or there can be all sorts, you know, a personal profile that can be very detailed could be available on the web quite easily. Then furthermore to that, I suppose, there's a security and state issues where do we really want a situation where a surveillance camera can recognise people, you know, can recognise someone on the street, because it would change the way we live our lives if we know that we have to be more careful of what we do on surveillance because we can always be recognised. Or indeed, if there's an audio feed in these surveillance cameras, it might change the way people interact or the way people talk.
Okay, so security issues to think about, and certainly on social sites like Bebo and MySpace, people do post a lot of personal information that could now be linked up and identified to a photo. Final quick question, when will PolarRose.com become available?
Polar Rose, at the moment, you can sign up on their site for the trial, you know, and it's like any of these things, it's selected people are trialing on it, and they've said, you know, spring 2007. So that's right now, you know, well, okay. Coming up right now. So we sort of await the full launch, but very soon, I think.
Okay, I know the search engine that I'd like. It's the one that would be built into my spectacles. And every time I see a face in a crowd that I know I should recognise and put a name to, and I won't be able to, it'll whisper in
maybe
my
not too
ear
far away.
And help me out. Okay, Ronan Fitzgerald, thank you very much. We'll
thanks
put details of those websites on our own programme website, and we'll give you the address for that at the end of the programme. Staying with technology, this week saw the launch of the latest new operating system from Microsoft called Vista. It replaces the Windows XP system that's been around for the last few years. Now, time was when the launch of a new Microsoft operating system was a major international event. This week's launch has been much quieter. So what will it mean for people with PCs? Well, joining me now is technology watcher Sean Coughlin. Sean, what's new about this latest operating system?
Hi. There are a lot of new features and a lot of features that have been upgraded in Vista. Some of the new things that people can look forward to are a brand new user interface. It has a much more 3D look and feel than what people are used to with XP. It's got a brand new web browser, Internet Explorer 7, and a new media player, Media Player 11. As well as that, a lot of the programs that have been upgraded have like everything from your Outlook to your contacts and calendar, as well as new games.
Okay, so new improvements and a new look and feel. What's the word on the street so far these last few days? Are people saying it's a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, it's been 5.5 years since the release of Windows XP. The word on the street, though, is that the average home user will not notice many of the improvements or make use of them.
And how would it affect the running of the PC? Is it because new offerings from Microsoft typically use up more and more of your memory, don't they?
Yeah, correct. The minimum requirements for Windows XP are about 1 gig of RAM, and you need a very, very powerful graphics card with 128 megs of memory. So there are a lot of home users who won't even be able to upgrade, so they'll need to certainly look into their minimum requirements.
Very good. Okay, look at your minimum requirements. Sean Coughlin, thank you very much. Now, finally, time for our weekly look at the world around us. And on this, the first day of spring, the ancient Celtic festival of Imbolg, we're going to take a look at the heavens above. Joining me on the line is one of our regular astronomy correspondents, Dave MacDonald. Dave, what should people watch for in the sky at night over the next few nights?
Hi, Mary. I think we'll concentrate on the planets. So if you haven't seen Saturn before, then tomorrow night, Friday, from about 8 o'clock onwards, there's an ideal opportunity to see Saturn. If you look for the moon, Saturn is no more than a finger width away from the moon, so you'll see it there. Also, if you look to the west after sunset, around about 5:30 at this time of year, you'll see a very, very bright star, which is, of course, Venus. So that's another good one to look out for. Now, for those folks that are maybe a little bit more advanced, possibly have a pair of binoculars, there is the chance to see Mercury at this time of year. So it is one that you do need to be careful of, because it is very, very close to the sun. So we don't want people looking at the sun directly, either naked eye or with binoculars. But if you hold a clenched fist out and have Venus on the left of your fist, then on your right-hand side, you will see a very bright object there, through binoculars anyway, and that will be Mercury. Of course, not many people have seen that, so that's a good one to look out for.
Okay, so that's Saturn, Venus and Mercury, and don't look at Mercury until just after the sun has set.
Absolutely.
Okay, and finally, congratulations. I gather you got the Astronomer of the Year Award. What was this for?
That's right, yes. It was from the Irish Federation of Astronomical Societies. And I was obviously very honoured to receive the award, basically for the work that I've done over the last 12 months in confirming a supernova from Ireland, the first one that was done, and also obtaining the first amateur observatory code in Ireland as well.
Well done on that. Dave MacDonald, thank you very much. Now, just time to mention that if you ever wanted to be an astronaut, then now is your chance, because New Scientist magazine has just launched a competition and they're offering one lucky reader a trip 62 miles up into space. All you have to do is come up with the most original nomination for the best patented invention of all time, and you have until the end of April, and you'll find more details at their website, newscientist.com. And finally, tomorrow sees the publication of a major international scientific report on climate change. The word is that the experts will be saying that climate change is likely to be even worse and happening sooner than anyone had expected. No doubt all will become clearer when that report is published tomorrow. That's it for this week. You'll find more information on the items in this week's programme on our programme website, rte.ie/radio1/quantum. And if you want to contact the team here, you can email us at quantum@rte.ie. Until next week, from me, Mary Mulvihill, Sláinte.